C'est final.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Tennis, the number one tennis podcast produced in association with the Golden Age of Tennis, with your host, Keith Fraser. Yes, that's me. And my sidekick and former British number one, Mr. John Lloyd. So, welcome to another edition of Rock and Roll Tennis. As always, I'm with my main man, the Bronze Adonis there in a picture.
John, listen, I had the pleasure of being with you in Indian Wells for World Scene Tennis. And it wasn't just being with you that was a pleasure, it was the weather. But here I am in sunny England. And of course, listen, sunny is not the word, because as they say, as long as you're sunny in your heart, that is what matters. And believe me, today, we're going on a summer holiday, so to speak, because at the end of the day, we have got an absolutely fantastic guest. And I've got the second record straight, John. I call you the housewife's heartthrob. Well, I'm very sorry, John, you are losing that title, because we've got someone else who's probably ahead of you in those stakes. I'm ever so sorry. You know, I'm a big fan of yours, John, but we've got to say it as it is, and I'm a man who does. Listen, what can I say about this guest? 60-plus year career in the music business, 250 million records worldwide. Third biggest artist, I think, in terms of single sales here in the UK, only behind the Beatles and Elvis. I mean, he needs no introduction, so I'm not going to introduce him. I think I'm just going to call him Sir. But actually, I am going to call him Sir, because it is Sir Cliff Richard OBE. Sir Cliff, welcome.
Thank you. What a fantastic introduction. Honestly, hearing that, I can't wait to meet you.
Well, listen, I know that, listen, you and John, you know each other well. But it is an absolute pleasure to meet you. As I said to you before we recorded this, Sir Cliff, by the way, what do I call you, sir? Do I call you Sir Cliff? Oh. Cliff, Mr. Richards, what should I call you?
You you can call me Cliff, but bow.
Okay, Cliff? Okay, here we go. Cliff, listen, it really is a pleasure because, look, as I said to you, if not the first record I bought was yours, Wired for Sound, when I was only 11 years old. I loved that record. And of course, you know, you are an unbelievably roaring success in the music business. And you are, I'm afraid, you've taken John's Housewife's Heartthrobs title. Tell me, first of all, how is it that someone like you is absolutely, like me and John, of course, mad on this wonderful game of tennis?
Well, you know, I came into the tennis world, so to speak, really late. I was 40 when I started hitting balls with friends, and I was really not very good. I'm still not very good. But it got me interested. I was always interested in Wimbledon, though. I used to love when Wimbledon came around and watched it on television. And then when I finally got invited to go to Wimbledon, I wasn't a member. And sometimes walking around, as John obviously knows, you're recognized quite quickly, and therefore crowds come to you. And I used to, when Wimbledon had the members area was down by the main church road entrance. I used to walk by there on tiptoe, hoping somebody in the club would recognize me and ask. And every now and then I did get asked in, and I just stood there quietly until the crowd left, and then I'd get back. But being a member now, John, well, it's fantastic, because they're building a car park now across the road from Centre Court, and there's going to be a tunnel. You can park your car and get into the tunnel, walk into Centre Court, and as a member, I can walk freely, therefore, and not be bothered all the time. Mm. And I mean, being bothered is part of our industry, but when you're going to watch tennis, the last thing you want is to be bothered. So yeah. I sit with people there. John, it's the only place where I sit with people and they call me young man.
That's right. I love it. Amazing, isn't it?
But you know, you're looking great and fit. You're still playing a lot of tennis, aren't you?
Yeah, I play a couple of hours a day. I play a lot of doubles, and yeah, I'm in pretty good shape. I'm doing a bit of teaching here, but I do enjoy. I wanted to ask you actually, but obviously, I know you've been a member for a while now. I mean, you presumably do get to play on the grass when you do go back there in the summer and play on grass or not?
No, I don't, because I don't live in Britain anymore. I reside in Barbados, but of course I visit Britain every year. Right. But when I come there for Wimbledon time, you can't play on the grass anyway.
No, you've got to do it afterwards.
And the last time I got there, it was sort of, I think it was October last year, and I played on the hard courts.
Oh.
I just hit balls with somebody. James Ward.
Oh, yeah.
James and another friend, we hit together, and we hit there, and we hit once on the inside undercover court because it was raining.
Yeah.
So, you know what happens when I get there and it rains. I have to sing. Fortunately, there's nobody there. Nobody.
I was going to ask you, Cliff, about that, you know, because obviously you are synonymous with, well, the rain and Wimbledon in a way. I never forget. I think it was the old number one court, I believe, the old number one court, when it was pouring with rain. We had a terrible week's weather, I think. And you led a sing-along of, ironically, one of your songs, Summer Holiday, which I thought was a bit of a wind-up, actually. But for us who have to sort of suffer that weather while you and John are over there in Barbados and Florida, respectively. But now, obviously, we have the roofs on the court. You're a multi-platinum-selling artist, and you're out of work.
Well, it wasn't Court 1, it was Centre Court.
Centre. Yeah,
and John will probably know, but they had BBC Wimbledon, and I, because there had been no play for a couple of hours, I'd said to them, if there's no play, get me and I'll come, we can interview me and we'll talk about tennis and stuff like that. So I was doing that, and it was in 1995, and I had just been made. That was my first year as a member of the club. And John, you know, you've got to wear that tie. You've got to wear the badge. And suddenly this bit of paper was put in front of me as I was being interviewed. And it said, the secretary of the club would like to see you, Sir Cliff. And I'm I'm thinking, I've got my tie on. I've got my badge. You know, I haven't done anything wrong. I got into the office and he said, is there anything you can do? It's been nearly 3 hours now. And I said, oh my God, I don't have a guitar here. What am I going to do? He said, well, what about, he said, well, if you can't sing, what about being interviewed? I went, yes, okay. And they got somebody from the TV sector and did an interview about 10 minutes. And John, at the very end of it, this guy said, well, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you, Sir Cliff, but ladies and gentlemen, I know you'd never forgive me if I didn't ask him to sing you something. No, and then of course at this point it was actually still pouring down with rain, and I thought to myself, you know, we Brits have had to deal with this weather for all our lives. So I said, okay, we're all going on a summer holiday. Of course, they all singing along and swaying in the rain. It was fantastic. And then of course I ended up doing about 20 minutes there, and of course all the girls, Pam Shriver.
That's right. I remember.
She was being massaged in the ladies' changing room, and she's got the TV on, and she said, stop, look, this is Cliff, and he's in our world, and he's entertaining our audience. Let's get up then. And up she came with Martina Navratilova, who had no idea who I was, and a few others. It was all the girls. And then I did about 20 minutes. In fact, I have to be honest, they couldn't get me off.
That was great. That was great.
I think they should stop the roof from closing just for you when the rain comes down, Cliff, no?
Yeah. Well, you know, once the roof went up, you know how journalists are? They can be pretty nasty sometimes. And, of course, one journalist was talking about tennis, and then he said the one wonderful thing, of course, is that because they've got the roof, we don't have to listen to you sing.
No, that's nice.
John. I said, remember this. I am the only singer who's ever played Centre Court.
That's right.
And I made my own racket.
That's right.
I like it. That is funny.
Well, it was. It's when I think back, it was so terrifying. And if somebody had said to me, you're going to play to the biggest audience ever in your life, maybe 500 million people, I don't know, watched it around the world, Tennis Wimbledon. And they said, you've got no music, you've got no rehearsals. I'd have said, no way. Generally, it was because it was an accident. It seemed to catch everybody's attention. And even now, John, when I walk into the club sometimes, I'll get somebody come up and they've got all misty eyes. And they're going to say, they said, 1995, we were there. And I realized, so was I, and wasn't it crap?
Unbelievable.
Was that the year? I don't know if it was the year when you had the Sunday play. I don't know if that was the year.
The what?
Do you remember the middle Sunday, the first time the middle Sunday was played because they had to catch up with matches? I can't remember if that was the year.
I think it might have been, actually.
It rained a lot that year, and mostly the rain came during the first week when it did come. And there were often days, John, you remember this better than I do, that often there would be days that you'd be in the members' enclosure having another, you know, drink or something. But it's just got better over these last years. Maybe the climate changes benefited Wimbledon. And, of course, it's been moved forward a bit now because of the French being so late for some of the players to get any grass practice. So it seems to me that when I go to Wimbledon almost every year, and I can't remember, every now and then there's a little stop for rain, but not like it used to be a whole day or something like that. But I think that day they might well have had to open up on the Sunday.
What I loved, Cliff, you know, Wimbledon were, in my opinion, and I told them it many times in articles, that they were very, very slow in getting a roof on the centre court first. And then obviously now we've got number one. But for me, I've always got gratitude. I think we all should, for the Australian Open, because the Australian Open really set the bar when they had, you know, the roof right away on the Rod Laver. And then they got a second one. And as we all know, even though none of the Grand Slams say this, they're in huge competition with each other. They don't say it, but they all are. They all want to be the best. And obviously Wimbledon, certainly reputation-wise, obviously Wimbledon is Wimbledon and it's been there the longest and so on. But the Australian, for a while there, was sort of, you know, had taken the sort of the mantle of being number one because you did have, you know, the indoor courts. And thank goodness it really pushed Wimbledon, you know, to do what they've done. And now, I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, when you get these rainy days, and now you know that these poor spectators who, you know, we forget that, Cliff, don't we? I think that we've been very fortunate to go there, you know, almost whenever we've wanted to. And you realise that some people literally spend all their life trying to get a ticket in the lottery. And in the old days, they would go there and then it would rain all day and it would be tough to get back and all this sort of stuff. And now we're the best again, and it's I'm so grateful for it.
I think so too. I think it was well past its time to come, and I think with Wimbledon, for instance, I know, for instance, when I'll go to see the American Open, they have this most amazing area which they call the President's Box.
Yes,
and all the not the President of the United States, the Presidents of the USTA. And I've been there a number of times as a guest, and it's so fantastic. They've got a huge dining area with huge amounts of stuff. And of course, I realized that because of the way Britain is, we're never ever going to build Wimbledon out that way towards the court so they can have a bigger and better restaurant. But taken advantage of everything else and done the massive jobs of the roofs. And I think that's going to always make a huge difference. I'm sure that we can never say that it'll never rain again in Britain. It will. That safety net is always there. And I love going. I almost prefer watching tennis because I started so late in life. I realized really early, you know, particularly when I've played with people who know what they're doing. And I remember I played with you and the guys when you were Davis Cup in Adelaide in Australia.
Mm.
And I hit with you all, and that's when I realized that I couldn't play tennis. You know? Even when I played tennis with Sue Barker, the guys in the club said to me, Did you win a game? I said, win a game? I didn't win a point. I said, yeah. Only time I actually hit the ball was when I served, because when the ball came back way beyond me. So in terms with that factor that as much as you could love tennis, unless you've played it from a very young age and been really trained and concentrated and had that determination to win, I know that I was never going to be any good. But I've improved, and it's fun for me now. I play tennis three times a week in Barbados, and there's a coach there that comes and hits with me and is constantly telling me what I'm doing wrong. I try to get it right, and then I do get it right when I'm practicing with him, and then when we play a game of doubles, I get it all wrong again. It's all terrible. I just want to get the damn ball over the net. Forget the tape.
I love it.
Terrific to be with you guys then. It actually changed my thought process about tennis, watching you all play the way you did. And I know you played Pat Cash.
Correct.
And you lost to him, I think it was 5 sets.
7-5 in the fifth.
Games won, and you had won more games.
Yeah.
And that's a funny thing about tennis. You can win more games during this 5-set match and still lose. I don't know whether they can ever change that, but it's one of those things, the excitement of tennis, I suppose. And then I remember something else. I trained with you because the guys were staying at the same hotel, and they had a running track around the tennis court upstairs. And I said, can I come with you? You said, okay, but I can't wait for you. And so we started running, and I slowly fell back about 25 feet. And then I thought, I'm going to keep it at 25 feet. And when we finished, I was still 25 feet behind you. And I felt so good. I thought, I've been flying that I can't
Great. Oh, I love it.
Can I ask you, Cliff, though? I mean, in terms of tennis, I mean, when you were a kid, were you always into sports and tennis and other sports, or was it purely music?
It wasn't music until I heard Elvis, which is when I was about 14, maybe 14 and a half. But it was a girl's game in those days. The girls played tennis and netball and things like that. And we guys played cricket, rugby and football. I didn't ever take to cricket. Rugby, I used to run, so I was quite fast. And rugby I quite enjoyed, and they put me on the wing. And I look back and think, I know why that was, because once they got the ball to me, I could run past everybody. And I mean, only about 13 or 14. And I'd run and drop the ball down. So I never got a broken nose. And I'm so grateful for that, because my career at that stage was not even a dream. And so it was terrific to play rugby. But my big claim to fame was that I played for Hertfordshire's under-14s football team.
Did you? I didn't know that.
Yes. So I've had a sporting background, but never that good at any of them. But tennis is the one that I've enjoyed most. Because it seems to me with football, for instance, or even cricket, you've got to get a team of people. Even with football, you've got to get at least 5 a side. Tennis, 2 people. That's all you need. Just millions. So it's been a much better sport for me to take. And I discovered when I play in Portugal, for instance, with another coach who comes 3 times a week, he works at a hotel and can only come to me after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And sometimes in Portugal, that's like 85, 90 degrees.
Mm.
Love it, John. I come off, I am bathed in sweat, and I'm thinking I have a great exercise. I check my heart, you know, the heartbeats, and it goes down pretty quickly. And so I thought to myself, I never expend that much energy in any one song. So tennis has also helped me perform on stage. It's given me more stamina.
Yeah.
You know what? Go on, sorry, John.
No, I was going to say, it's a funny thing, Cliff. You know, you can, with tennis, you can train and do outside training, you know, whether it's running or gym work or whatever, but you can't copy tennis. The training, the physical part of training with the, I suppose it's because it's the sort of the interval kind of training. I can, if I stop playing tennis for a couple of weeks, but still do other training, I come back on the court and I'm out. I feel like I'm out of shape again. Tennis is an amazing fitness regime that keeps you in great nick if you do it regularly. There's no doubt about it.
Well, you know, I recognize that fact as well, even as an amateur, John. You know, sometimes when I left Barbados in October to go and do my tour, and it was about 2 months away. When I got back, I couldn't serve a ball that went in. And I'm thinking to myself, now when players say we've not had enough match practice or, you know, not had time to train, you because you're at such a high level, that drop in the level that you're talking about makes it impossible for you to catch up unless you start training all part again. It is a much tougher, much more demanding game in terms of training. I'm not quite sure how much training you need to play golf, for instance. You need, because it's all much more under control in terms of the way you hit. And the other thing I've noticed is that I noticed that a lot of tennis players, I don't know if it's true of you, but they like to play golf. Mm. I mean, because it's a ball that's not moving and not spinning in any particular direction. And it must be somehow not easier, but more likely that you're going to be able to play golf because you keep the eye on the ball. Again, it's all to do with watching the ball. And and so it's a game that I noticed. I tried golf, but it never got me. It never got me. Tennis would get me up. I don't do that anymore, but I used to get up quite early in the morning to go and play at your brother's club, David's club, at, near the airport. But golf never got to me. But there again, you know, it's a bit like music. You either like this music or don't like somebody else's. If you don't like somebody else's, it doesn't make it bad. It's just that you don't like it.
Right.
So it's one of those things. And Wimbledon time still is an absolute treat for me. Not only do they call me young man, but I sit amongst people who have played on that center court. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I feel quite privileged, quite honored.
You get starstruck, Cliff. Do you get a bit starstruck then?
No, not starstruck, but it's like you feel like when you sit next to somebody. I usually sit next to some of the older women members. And one time, before the roof was there, the ball was hit. You know, on the side of the court, they roll up the covers.
Right.
When the ball was hit, it went under the cover. And then they spent about 5 minutes looking for the thing. Anyway, this woman said, oh, she said, that happened to me once. I said, where? She said, right there. I said, but when centre court? She said, yes. I was playing in the semi-final, and the ball went under. And when it came out, I took a long time to serve, and people booed me. So I'm thinking, I'm sitting next to someone who has played on centre court. So you can't help but be kind of in awe of it, much, you know, starstruck, but certainly in awe.
Who was it?
I can't remember. I can't remember. I don't think I would have recognised her name.
Probably Angela Mortimer, Angela Barrett.
Probably. No, their names. No. It was somebody else who hadn't made it huge, but had played central.
I was going to say, Cliff, I mean, I'm sure John has as well. I know you're very kind with your time, but I was thinking about it. I've got to have an ankle operation, so I really plan to start playing tennis again. But I did have a hit last week because my little boy, for a birthday present, got me a hit with a coach. And I have to say, I was thinking about this and I thought I'd ask you because, look, we know that many people in Hollywood, in music and stuff, they have issues with drugs and drink and so forth. And I've got to say, hitting a tennis ball and you hit it nicely, it feels trance-like. And I was just thinking, is tennis a sport that you would recommend many, you know, Hollywood actors and musicians and stuff who struggle with themselves and turn to things like that? Do you think, tennis got to be something you recommend for them, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first thing is, if you're feeling down and out, the best thing to do is play tennis. You have to watch that damn yellow ball, otherwise you're not going to play. So suddenly you're focused on something. And that's what when I play tennis, I don't really think of much else. And I'm sure it's good. It's good therapy to actually try to forget anything that might be worrying you. Tennis, you can only get that ball over the net if you're watching it. And, you know, this is something that John's said many times, I'm sure, as a coach and everything. You know, you've got to keep your eye on the ball and watch it onto the racket. Now, I don't always get it right. I watch it till it comes to the net, and then I think, where am I going to put it? And the eyes are going all over the place. But when I do it right, it works. And generally speaking, if I'm playing for an hour with a coach, I tend to forget everybody else, everything else, and just hit and hit and hit. We play games. He did something clever with me very early on in this coaching time with me. He said, I'm going to ask you to do something that I asked these kids to do. He said, these kids want to win the point on the first ball they hit. He said, you get the ball 4 times over the net, you get a point. And then you're going to have to try and stop me getting the next point. If you get the next point, you'll get the double point. So, and it was fantastic because then it made me think, yeah, I hit the ball over the net. My fourth shot has to be something that makes it a little more difficult. He's a coach, so nothing's going to be impossible for him. And so I suddenly realized I had to hit the ball either very deep or at least try to get a sideline so that he's running and therefore more vulnerable. And, you know, I started winning a bit, but in the end, winning, You know, when you're given a point and you get to six love because you won your four, just hit the ball four times over the net, it's not exactly winning, but it made me think of my game more. And it has helped me. But it takes me, and coming back to what you said, John, when I get back to Barbados now and start playing, I'll have been away a whole month. And I know that the stamina will have dropped down a bit. I'll make all sorts of mistakes. And it takes me, a couple of months to get back. It's just one of those things.
But yeah.
In my love of the tennis away, never. I can watch it live and love it. I can watch it on TV and love it.
I love it. One of the questions I wanted to ask you, you know, being in the entertainment world that you've been in, obviously you still are, and, you know, Wimbledon is separate. The Grand Slams are sort of, Grand Slams, you could almost have, you know, Mickey Mouse playing Minnie Mouse and people are going to go, because it's a place to be now. It's an event. But the rest of tennis, in my opinion, we don't market it. We're missing out on it in some ways because it's really the only sport you can play for life other than golf. And let's face it, with tennis, you get certainly more exercise than golf. As a great entertainer, when you watch it on TV and you go to stadiums, not Wimbledon, because you know, again, that's a beast on its own, but the other events that you've seen, is there anything that you could see that you think, you know what, they should be doing this, a way to some sort of an entertainment, a way to bring it to the masses, something before the matches, after the matches. I don't know what I'm trying to say here, but something that you feel like maybe there could be an improvement that could get more people, you know, to hit the ball, you know, go out actually on the courts and play.
Well, I'm not sure because
I mean, rules of the game that you think might be.
Well, the rules of the game. Well, I don't know. The rules are hard to change anyway. The only rule I'd like to see change is the net point rule. You know, you have to serve again if you get hit the net. But if you hit the net during a point, you win the point, probably. And I always think ball can't reach your opponent. Then if it bounces twice, for instance, before it gets to the opponent, let play the net court. But usually at the pace that you guys serve, the ball just clips it and it still arrives at about 90 miles an hour.
Yeah, anyway.
So, that's the only thing. But again, you know, what do I know? I mean, I'm just a viewer who has that one point that I think would make it better to see you. Especially if you're watching somebody that you've been following. I became a big fan of Murray's and I watched everything he played. And sometimes, you know, this last year, I think he got through to a third round. But in the second round, getting to the round, he had to win that last point. The guy served to him and started to run to the net. And Murray lobbed him to the baseline and won the match. And I'm thinking, I don't know how I think Agassi said he's a natural player and doesn't necessarily plan things, but he just does what he has to do at that time. And we all watched there, and the ball went zooming over the guy's head and jumped and fell 2 feet inside the baseline, and he won the match. So I like watching people play like that. But if I watch someone like Murray play and he hits the ball at 120 miles an hour and it only arrives because it's hit the net at 115, I feel, no, it should be played. It should be played. Mm. So anyway, I don't know. Wimbledon, you see, the thing about Wimbledon is it has this amazing background, as you say. It's the longest running tournament. Although, funny enough, I believe the French invented tennis, but they didn't have slams, I suppose, when it was invented. But as a Grand Slam, I don't know of a single player that doesn't want to win Wimbledon.
Correct.
I bet you that Lendl would give up half his titles to say that he won Wimbledon.
Yep.
He got to like three finals. And the funny thing is, I remember John, he said something very funny very early on in his career. They said, what about Wimbledon? He said, Wimbledon is for grass. It's for cows. Yeah. And I said, Wimbledon is for cows because it's on grass. Had he come in those early days, don't you think he might have won it because he got so close and yet he came to play on grass? But anyway, so Wimbledon has all these special things about it, and changing too much of it might, for instance, when I go to America, the one thing that really annoys me is the loud music that goes on while you're watching the players trying to get tuned in again for the next game. It drives me crazy. They do play some fabulous music, though. You can't help but go, yeah. But I still think that, to me, that's not right. I don't feel right about it. But as to how you present it to the public in Britain as tennis, I'm not quite sure. I'd have to think about that someday, but I wouldn't have put it forward, I don't think, because, you know, I think the guys that run it are pretty good. I just feel that you are right. If we could make this not just an event, it's something that maybe you could do. I know that when I started my tennis foundation about, I don't know, almost 30 years ago, and we did it for 20 years, we went to schools and we thought, okay. And then of course people, like, we talked about Wimbledon and tennis and wouldn't you like to play tennis? And, you know, we did quite well. We introduced in my time about 250,000 kids to tennis who'd never really hit ball before. And so maybe more of that could happen. You know, maybe the Wimbledon and the tennis association could think about how to reach people when it's not Wimbledon time.
Yeah, outside. Good.
The events are still going on, and I think it's great that we now have a Wimbledon. I don't know if we play. Do we play wheelchair? Yeah, we play wheelchair Wimbledon, don't they?
Yeah, definitely.
So
it's Alfie Hewitt. He's who I met last week, and hopefully he's going to come on this show. Won all the Grand Slams, I believe, John, hasn't he?
That's correct.
That's right. Yeah, he said. And the funny thing is, it's quite fascinating to watch a wheelchair match, because the technique that they use and the ideas they have are exactly the same as when you're running the baseline. You can see they hit the ball here. It's coming back. You know darn well he's going to hit it cross court, and sure enough, he does. And it's amazing. I know they've got the privilege of two bounces, but even then, you know, John, I played a charity match when I had my charity running, and it was against wheelchair players. And now I'd only played tennis for about 3 years. Anyway, I served the ball and aced him. I got booed. And I said, I didn't know I could do that. All over the net. So anyway, but they're very interesting to watch, those wheelchair players. And if we could get something going that goes to, you know, when you park past all those parks, there's tennis courts, and some of them are a bit run down. Some of the large money that comes into the LTA and to Wimbledon, maybe some of it didn't be a massive amount, just to make those courts maybe better and encourage people to play more. I can't see another way around it, really. But again, Wimbledon, I think, is always going to be the number one watch a match. You must have been to America a million times. I love it there because the excitement from the crowd is ginormous. The only thing is, it spreads over into those moments when it's supposed to be quiet. I mean, you must have seen it. I've seen somebody toss the ball and somebody's going, kill him! And they stop and let the ball bounce. In England, if there's a shout, they look up and go, how dare you sneeze? I'm about to serve. And of course, so, you know, being a fan of, you know, Murray and Tim, it's interesting. Of course, we would go crazy if they win a point. And we would applaud the other guy if they won the point. But when it came to serving, you suddenly hear, and it was like a vacuum in the arena. And then you saw the guy serve. And then there's a special thing. And I think it's the way we truly respect tennis and tennis players in Wimbledon. And I guess the players must feel that. Even though I've talked to tennis players and they say, oh, no, we love going to America. It's like fun and games for them. And even when the pandemic happened, I watched a couple of matches in America, and they had put screens up at the side of the stage with previous audiences that they'd filmed. And every time someone won a point, they'd put the sound up, and everybody would be going, yeah. So they're quite inventive over there. But I still think of all the tournaments, I think Wimbledon is ahead. Australia's. Yeah. I liked Australia. Tennis in France didn't appeal to me, funny enough. I don't know why.
This is not Sir David, and I'm not in the jungle. But if I were, I would still be wearing some of the rare and beautiful clothing that can only be found on the Golden Age of Tennis website. In this incredible habitat, you will find the elegant Borg alongside the lesser spotted McEnroe. Truly magnificent plumage for both on and off the court. GoldenAgeOfTennis.com. Classic styles for the winners of today.
There's no place like Centre Court, Cliff. I mean, I've been to football stadiums and all around the world and so forth. But I can, and I say it every time, I love all the Grand Slams, but there is no place more special than the Centre Court Wimbledon. It's just, you have to be there to understand it. It's like watching a sport in your living room. It's just unbelievably special. And that's not because I'm a Brit.
Yeah, Keith, but you're right. But you see, what also makes it special is that it is the only Grand Slam that is not played on a public court. All the others are public courts. In other words, you can play on those courts, the Centre Court, even.
Yeah. Whether they're
a thing in Australia or France or America, but anybody can book a court and go and play the Billie Jean court or whatever. In Wimbledon, no. It's only the players and members. And, you know, they used to joke about saying the best and easiest way to become a member is to win Wimbledon. You can't get it. So that's what's special too. That's what, whenever I've been there, like this last November I was there, there's nobody there, but we had a quick look at the court, and you go and you look at the court, and it's not what it is because it was being dealt with and getting prepared. And there's still that thing of thinking only the best can be here. Only the best have walked on that grass. No businessman has got an hour to kill. It's all to do with the tennis and the people who play it.
Yeah, it's very special. I've got to ask you, Cliff, though, because you have such a long career in the music business, you know, iconic. And we always have this debate, and actually it's boring, but people talk about who's the greatest of all time. Now, I'm a sports fan in a number of sports. Tennis is my favorite, of course, but I remember interviewing Arsene Wenger and asking him who the greatest football player was. And he said, Lionel Messi. I said, not Maradona. He said, no. In his opinion, and I believe the reason he said that was because of Messi's longevity of his career, whereas Maradona obviously had a shorter period. And I think when you look at the players today, you look at the longevity of your Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic. It spans over so many years, like your musical career. In your opinion, what makes someone the greatest of all time? I mean, I guess you've got to bring yourself into that argument in the same voice.
But see, how do you tell who's the greatest? With tennis, you know, because people win. We don't either win or lose. You know, you either make a good record against the number one, and if it doesn't, you try and you get the number one next time. And it's a kind of different way of trying to say who's the greatest. You can say who's lasted the longest, and I might up for run for that. I mean, last year when I released the contemporary album, it was released in November last year. It came in at number 3 in the album charts. Now, I got a phone call to my office, and they rang me and said, are you sitting down? I said, yeah. And they said, your album's in the charts. I said, I know, I saw it, number 3. They said, yeah, but what you don't know is that the people who run the charts have just called us and said that you're the first, and you may be the only one who's done this. You're the first to have a top 5 album in 8 consecutive decades.
Wow.
I thought myself, oh my God, that's impossible. It's one of those things you can't plan. You can't plan to do that. When I was 17 and making my first record, I was thinking 1 week ahead, maybe 1 month ahead, never, not even 1 year ahead. I could never have thought of, oh, in 8 decades time, I'll be. No, it just happened, and I don't know how, I don't know why, but I am thrilled about it. Whereas other things like tennis and football, you can see by, you know, by how many goals are scored, who scores the most, that they probably would be one of the best. Or as you say, longevity. Longevity is in my favor, because from my point of view, is anybody else going to have 8 consecutive decades of hit albums? I don't know, but first of all, they're going to have to get as old as I am. And not many. And the fact that I can still run and play tennis, I can still move about on stage. This last tour I did, I had to think to myself, I'm 81. I became 81 during the tour. I need to be able to be a rock and roller, but not lose dignity. So I just did everything in smaller paces. And I'd maybe stroll across to one side of the stage and do a wiggle or so, and then come back. And every now and then I twirl. But I thought to myself, at least I feel I'm an 80-year-old singing pop rock music which cannot be sung standing at the mic or sitting down. I feel you move. Elvis moved. Little Richard jumped around on his piano and thumped him. You know, everything was movement. So for me, I can't put myself into that category other than in terms of being the oldest. Maybe that's going to be my claim to fame. And by the way, Keith, you said that I had sold 250 million records. That figure was counted more than 30 years ago. I'm probably closer to 300 million now.
I said 300. I'm sure I said 300, but maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. If I said 250, I am so sorry. What's 50 million? What's 50 million between friends, huh?
It's not an offense at all. It's just that because it was said, it was such a big number 30 years ago to have sold 250 million records, that it stuck with it. So I constantly get, and I love to be able to clear it up and say, no, I've got this 300 million. But the thing is, you know, you mentioned about being third to Elvis and the Beatles. One journalist said to me, are you upset by that? I said, are you serious? Me upset about being third to the Beatles and Elvis? Of course not. I'm number three, and I never sold many records in the biggest market in the world, America. They had America. I had only the rest of the world. So had I got America, Elvis and the Beatles may have been very worried. Get it. And you know, John, at the moment, I come to America, and as I say, I have an ordinary life here. And people say, well, don't you miss being famous? I say, no, not really. I said, but if I miss being famous, I could just go back to England or play in Europe or go to Australia or go to Southeast Asia and have my fill of fame and then come back. But it's nice to be friends with people who didn't know what I did for a living. You know, about the third meeting, they'd say, what do you do for a living? I'd say, look, you know my name. Can you Google me? And the next time they'd meet me, they'd slap their hands over their mouth and go, oh, my God.
Does anybody call you by your birth name? No, never.
I changed it by Deep Pole. I started my career when people like Elvis Presley and Buddy Holly and Ricky Nelson and Little Richard, Harry Webb did not sound right. Harry Webb. So, I mean, nowadays nobody really cares, but for me, I needed to feel that I was going to be part of that group of phenomenal rock and rollers. And so I just changed it to Cliff Richard. Somebody suggested Russ Clifford. I said, sounds a bit soft. Russ is a bit rounded. Okay, what about Cliff Russard? I went, Cliff? Now that's a rock face, rock and roll. Cliff's good. The guy that wrote Move It for me in Samwell, my first record, said, Richards. No, take the S off. So I became Cliff Richard, which was a tribute to Little Richard. And I had two Christian names. And sure enough, very often people would call me Cliff Richards in an interview and I would be able to mention my name twice because I'd say, no, it's got no S. It's just Cliff Richard. So it was a great way of doing it. I'm very happy. My family call me Cliff. Everybody calls me Cliff.
Unbelievable. Actually, I've got loads of questions. And I don't want to keep you because I know you're busy, as is John. But, you know, there's so many things been going on with COVID and so forth. And me and John have talked about this, which is the press. And I know you've had your run-ins with the press yourself. And obviously we're all delighted that you come out the other side and you look great and feel great. This year, we've had situations like the Naomi Osaka situation. Now, from somebody who's been under the magnifying glass of the press, you would be a very good person to give your opinion on what you think about how tennis players deal with the press, because of course without the press she wouldn't be where she is, and to a certain degree you wouldn't have been where you are as the successful artist you've been. I'm sorry to sort of hog the question there, John, but I'm just curious to know what you think about the whole press situation. And obviously we've had a recent one with Peng Shuai, the Chinese female player. What is your feeling about the press and tennis, professional tennis, Cliff?
I can only look at it from the way of the viewer looks at things. The press can be really good. What we've lost, though, is that there was one journalist who had a book out, and he was speaking to Nick Ferrari on LBC. And Nick said to him, I really enjoyed the book, very funny, it's great stuff. He said, What is it factual? And the journalist said, come on, Nick, you know that we can't let facts stop a good story. For me,
yeah,
there you
wrong. It's not that. It should be the truth that you tell. And the way that you tell that truth can either make you cry or laugh. That's to me the art form of journalism. But unfortunately, it's far too easy just to be either crude or rude or untruthful to make a story. And so tennis players are big stars these days. And so I know what it's like to be a big name. And, you know, I'll tell you one thing that happened. They were talking about the technology. And I said, I love the technology. In the studios now, we can do, I can sound like a choir by multi-tracking over these tracks. And I said, and there's no reason to be out of tune, because if you've seen something out of tune, they say, oh, we've got a machine that will put it right. You say, no, I'll do that line again. So you can do it. And I said, and I happened to mention, I heard one of the guitar solos in the Beatles, one of the Beatles albums, the guitar seemed out of tune to me. I said, and I don't know why it went there, because they could have just done it again. The headline in the journalist was Cliff slams the Beatles. Hello? I didn't slam the Beatles. I was trying to figure out, okay, we would never, the Shadows would never have left a out-of-tune guitar going. But you know, it's not knocking the Beatles. The Beatles are the biggest band that have ever happened on the planet. And it's no good trying to judge them. They made great songs, they wrote great songs. I just made this one point, trying to say that technology has taken away what used to be a lot of bad notes maybe in recording, because you can overdub or tweak it so that you're singing the right note. And so it's one of those things that tennis players are going to have to learn to live with and say, okay, I've got to be careful what I say and just hope that they get it right. And then if they don't get it right, most people know that you can't believe everything that you read. So, you know, when tennis players are going through a bad time, I'm just hoping that they'll have someone with them that says, you know, are you still getting tennis? Are you still going to win points? Are you going to win a match? And they'll say, yes, of course. So their lives needn't change at all. You just have to put up with the fact that sometimes the journalist will just be thinking about himself. I don't think often that they think of us as human beings. We're just... And it's really hard to be fodder. It's not hard. It's not easy to accept. But we are, because we are who we are. You know, Naomi, Emma, they're all of them, the guys as well. They just have to learn to say, okay, it's happened, but it hasn't changed my life. I'm still playing tennis. I'm still going to play tennis. I'm going to win another match. I will win another match. I did win another match. And so that's the only way around it. I can't really give an advice as to how to get past it, other than to never speak to them again. And then again, there's no point in that. If you have about your love of life, and tennis maybe your love of life, you want to express it. You want to express what it does for you, what it does for other people, what it can do for other people. So I just learned to live with the nice stuff and ignore the bad stuff.
Yeah, that, because the trouble is what you don't want to see, you know, which is the worry these days, is you don't want to see these press conferences or interviews, TV interviews, where, and it's going to happen the way things are going, because it's even happening now with announcing. When I do commentating, you're so frightened about what you say, because anything can be twisted. That the problem is that players will, there won't be any personalities anymore, because I mean, to be quite frank, if I had a player right now who's going into a press conference, a young player, I would tell them just to basically say the basics, you know, that I played well today. Oh no, she's a really good player. Or, and you know, which to be honest is a bit boring, but otherwise you lay yourself open these days for anything, as you say, can be taken three different ways, and they'll go for the bad way in so many cases.
I think so, because it's too tempting for them to do that. As you say, it shouldn't be boring though. I mean, for instance, when Djokovic got beaten, was it Wimbledon? I can't remember.
US Open.
Was it America?
A few months ago. Yes, Medvedev.
He just had nothing but good things to say about the person that won.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, you know, no, wait a minute, I'm thinking about the one Wait a minute, it wasn't Wimbledon, was it? It must have been the American, because he lost to
Yeah, to Medvedev. Djokovic, Medvedev. Did Djokovic lost Medvedev.
That's right. And he just said, I lost. And he played a great match. He said, but, and he turned around to the crowd. He said, but you touched my heart today.
Yeah,
because it was wonderful. They were cheering for him to win. And he just gave that little thought. He said, he played better than I did. You too, great. But you folks here, you touched my heart. And I thought, that's what people want to hear. But I'm not sure I read it anywhere.
No, exactly.
They've written it. But, journalism is journalism. And it's I don't know how we'll ever get it the way we want it. And it's not as though we want to be talked about all the time in just the right way that we think's right. If we say something wrong, it's all right to say it, but it should not be a criticism, because none of us are perfect. So I think you're right, though, is to say, look, just talk about the match. Did you enjoy it? Yeah, I enjoyed it. I lost, but I enjoyed. He played fantastically. What about that shot he did there? I just couldn't get to it.
Right. Well,
and that's the only way to get around it if you're going to try and beat the press at their game.
That's a shame, really, because, many people, John said it, we've all said it, that there's not enough personalities in today's game. And I only at Wimbledon a few months ago, Boris Becker in a commentary box made a comment about, I can't remember whose girlfriend, but he said, she's certainly very pretty. Nothing wrong in that in my eyes. But the press the next day was saying, oh, you are making... you're making misogynist comments and making women to be the like objects. I mean, it's gone completely the other way, I think.
Well, that's ridiculous. I've heard women say, John's very handsome. I mean, I don't think that would have been considered at all. Why not say that someone's pretty?
He's the bronzed Adonis, Cliff. I told you.
But the thing is, it's like somebody that I know, a radio journalist, had said to about some dancer saying, she's a bit, she's a bit, not podgy, a bit, with a bit of weight. And I'm thinking, and he had to come off his radio show because he got such bad press. And I'm thinking,
John Inverdale.
Coronation Street, the old Coronation Street from way back, one of the characters said, I love that chubby. Oh, that's the word. Oh, she is a bit chubby. The dancer's a bit chubby. And he was almost got sued, but he had to come off the radio for a while. And I'm thinking, this woman called me chubby. You know what it did for me? It changed my life. I went on a diet. And look, I'm weight free now. It's fantastic. So I would never have considered that a rude thing to say. It's a comment about somebody else. And that's why we've got to be really careful. It is getting to be beyond acceptance that you can't actually pay a compliment to a woman in case she says, oh, he's making a play for me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a shame, really.
Yeah.
Mm. By the way, Cliff, before we wrap up, I was in Indian Wells recently supporting John, who was captaining the San Diego Aviators in World Team Tennis. By the way, you talk about exciting. That is a fantastic format. I don't know if you've gone, but the reason I bring it up is because I met somebody who was a friend of John's who went on the road with you. And I think he said he went on the road once with Sir Elton John as well, a coach. What was his name? Was it Donald?
Donald Watt,
yes. Elton only got the idea from me because he came from Scotland, and David, your brother, had him as a coach in Heston. And so we played together. And I said, look, when I go away, it's so hard to play tennis. Can you come on the tour? It was the Tour of Australia. And he said, well, what will it entail? I said, well, I'd like to play 3 or 4 times a week. And if you can get the phone numbers and arrange it for me, we can go and hit. And he did. And I don't know whether it's because Elton heard that I'd done that, but he used Don as well. So, it was very, very good. But the trouble is nowadays, for instance, as I get older, the days off, for instance, are days that you travel to the next gig. So it gets a bit difficult when you travel, you sleep late, you travel in the afternoon, and you've got to be at the sound check at 4:30. It's hard to play tennis at 3 or something like that when you know all this is ahead of you. So I've given up doing that now. I just play tennis when I've got the free time, when I'm in Barbados or Portugal. And maybe now in Florida, now that I've got a friend on the other end of the line.
Well, this show is also Friends Reunited, isn't it, John? And Cliff, wouldn't you say? This is Friends Reunited here.
Yeah. Cliff, I have to just ask you one more silly question, but it's just I'm just curious because you all these years ago and you told me about it and I thought you were nuts, but now I sort of do what you do, but I don't know if you still do it, but you told me years and years ago that you only used to eat one meal a day and that was what you used to do. And I do that. I don't do that quite now, but I do this sort of 16-hour sort of fasting and I don't eat after sort of 8 o'clock till 12 the next day. And it's made me feel really good. I just wondered if you still do that or not.
No, I don't. I used to have one meal a day because every time I went on holiday, I'd come back and I'd put 10 pounds on in a month or 3 weeks. And then during rehearsals, I would starve. I would have a cup of coffee in the morning, nothing in the afternoon, and a small meal at night. So that was the one meal a day. Then I met somebody who was a masseuse, and she said to me, have you heard of the blood type? It's not a diet, lifestyle. Mm. So what I do now, I eat what's right for my blood type. And being an A positive, there are 10 foods that I can't eat and hundreds of others that I can. So now I do that. And so far, what it did for me, I did lose about, when she said to me, even if you don't do the diet completely, give up wheat and dairy. And I did. And within 3 months, I lost 1.5 inches around my waist. And I thought, oh. And then I started the regime. I didn't lose any more weight. I didn't put weight on. And as long as I stick to the things that I can eat lots of it. I don't
mind
it. I don't eat lots because what happens is, as well, your stomach shrinks a bit, I suppose, and you lose appetite. But I've only got to smell, you know, bacon frying, and you want to eat again. One of those things I can't have. What, do you know what your blood type is, by the way?
I do, because you give blood. And I did exactly the same thing as you, Cliff. I went on the blood type diet. But the trouble is, I love coffee, and I'm an O type, and you're not allowed to have coffee.
Ah, I see. Now, I'm A type. Coffee is one of the pluses, one of the benefit foods, as is peanuts. There are a number of things that are beneficial, but not multiple things. And so you eat those sort of things when you can, as often as you can. And then I have to stick. I can't eat red meat, no wheat, no dairy, no red meat, as I say, no crustaceans, no mangoes, papayas, bananas, no tomatoes, potatoes, or aubergines. Now, look, aubergines, favorite vegetable. Mangoes, favorite fruit. Loved shrimps. I gave them up, and you know what? I don't miss them. The only thing I miss is tomatoes, because some of the best curries have tomato, and the best pastas, tomatoes. So what I do is I have 4 steaks a year. I had one 2 days ago, and we planned it 2 weeks before, and I couldn't wait for the day to have that steak. That's what I'm doing now. I'm eating what's right for me, and it seems to be working. It can't be just good luck. And but even then, you know, they do say that you should try and stop eating for a day, give up eating. What do they fast for a day? Mm. I've never done that yet.
No, you look great. You look great, I must say.
You do look great. You do look great. Look, John, I don't know if you've got any more questions for Cliff. I know that I've got one or two more. If you don't mind, I'm ever so sorry, Cliff, for keeping you. You've been absolutely great, and it really is fantastic talking to you. Listen, you've obviously played. I mean, Sir Elton took your coach, and we're actually trying to get Sir Elton onto the show, but I know he took your coach. You've obviously played a number of well-known people. Give us an example of some of the people you've hit with, and who's the best, and who are the people you've beaten?
Oh, well, I've hit with John Lloyd and his team at Blade. I've hit with Steffi Graf. It was funny. Oh, Steffi's coach was a
Russian. Hart, was it? Wasn't Hart's good? No, maybe not. No, wasn't Hart's good? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, he was. The
thing is that she came in with her family to see a concert when I played in Germany. It was near her hometown. And we had dinner. I said, I'll cook dinner. She said, well, they said, oh, she won't come to dinner because she's on a diet and practicing and all that. So, she did come to dinner, but she left early. And then she said, before she left, she said, would you like to play tennis tomorrow? I said, Yes. And so she said, well, here's the number of the club. I'll book it and come up at 10 o'clock or something. So I got there at 10 and Pavel.
Oh, Schlossil. Schlossil.
Oh, Schlossil.
That's it.
Okay. Now, he sat at the side and I'm hitting balls with Steffi. And you know when they talked about Steffi, they said her footwork was so fantastic. One of the things that was disturbing for me is that it looked as though, you know, when you're trying to keep your eye on the ball and keep a vision, a sort of side vision of your opponent, she seemed to be floating. She must have used multiple steps to move because it wasn't like a run that's where she head was bumping up and down. It seemed like she was floating, and no matter where I hit the ball, she was there. She was always just there. And it was Pavel Sonsel that said, Steffi, I want to play with him. And I'm thinking, I want to play with Steffi. He wants to play with me, and I can't hit the ball.
That's great.
So we did that, but she was fantastic. And I played with a couple of other people I can't remember, but it's interesting. The more you play, of course, I played with Sue quite a lot. It's just when you play with real tennis players, it really puts you in your place, that you really know this is something that you... I'm so glad I enjoy it. I'm so glad that there are other people of my age who play at my standard and we can have such fun. In fact, one time when I played with Sue at Wimbledon at grass time, and there were a bunch of... Kitty Godfrey was still alive then.
Oh, my heavens.
That's how long ago it was. And there were two men, two women playing doubles, and they never stopped laughing. So Sue said, let's stop for a minute and see what they're doing. They were drop-shotting each other and the other person couldn't get to it because they had a big round. It was so funny. And I thought, look at that. They're playing, these people, Kitty Godfrey won Wimbledon. You know, they're playing tennis at this age and having fun. And that's what it should become. It shouldn't become something that was, oh, what a shame I didn't win that match, but what a shame I won all those others. So it's a great sport, I must say.
It is a great sport. And one last thing, Cliff, I'm ever so sorry. I know you've got that beautiful sunshine. You're looking out the window. I'm looking out here. It's already dark, but it's probably raining. John, it's your favourite question, which is, John, do you know what I'm referring to?
What did you say?
So John likes to ask our guests what they're, if they were able to make a robot tennis player, isn't it, John? Something like that?
Oh yeah. I always like it for the men primarily, but I mean women as well. But I always like to say that all the people that you've seen, if you were going to make a favorite shots of people that you've seen, in other words, you know, the best server you've seen, the best forehand, best backhand, and best volley. I always think it's just fun to hear what people say, all the players that you've seen. And
so you'd have to put the robot you're making, you'd need the legs of Nadal.
Yeah.
I would have thought you need the instinct of Murray.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who's the best? Who won? Sampras was one of the best servers. He seemed to be able to serve out of all sorts of messes. I mean, correct. That's what I...
Volleys?
Sorry?
Volleyers? So, volleyer? Best volley? Best person in volleys, you've seen?
Who's he was a Swedish guy.
Edberg.
Edberg.
Oh, there you go.
Edberg for volleys, yeah.
Wow. Okay, that's pretty good group.
But we should actually build our own robots and have the robots play each other.
Yeah, exactly. Fantastic.
Listen, Cliff, John, I'm ever so sorry. I know that you've met Cliff numerous times and I know you're going to be seeing him very soon, I'm sure, and when you get together for the hit or dinners. Cliff, you've been absolutely great. Like I said, you look great, you sound great. I'm sure you play great. And once I've had my ankle up, maybe I'll have a hit with you sometime. That'll be so. Cliff, I want you to keep safe, keep well, keep playing, and I really hope we can do this again because, you know, you share the passions that I have and, of course, that John has. It's been a treat.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's been my pleasure. Absolutely pleasure. I love talking about tennis. I love talking about music and everything.
Well, next time we can even have a little jam together, maybe next time, and sing a song like...
Don't, Keith, please.
I'm only kidding.
Yeah, Keith. Please, my advice is don't bother.
No, I'm not. Listen, I wouldn't want to. Listen, you know, it's a bit like being in the men's shower for me, believe me. Look, it's been great, honestly. You've been fantastic. Okay. It's always great with John. John's a buddy. I enjoyed spending time with him in the States recently.
John, thank you so much. And if I get the chance, I'll give you a call.
Please, okay. That would be great. Thanks, Cliff.
It'll be great fun. Thank you. Which court do you use here? Do you use that it was Chris's dad's court.
Holiday Park.
Yeah.
Holiday Park. Jimmy Evans. Well, yeah, I play Coleridge, play all over the place. We'll sort something out, no problem.
Okay. Well, I'll leave the choice to you. But if I can get away, I'll call you.
Thank you. That would be great. All thanks so much.
Nice to see you as well. Thank you very much for doing
lovely
that.
Lovely to Cliff Richard there, John. Wow, lovely guy. Listen, it really was a treat because he is such a nice guy. And, well, look, I think he is friends reunited, John. I'm sure you're going to see more of him again.
Yeah, well, he's you know, he's just a great guy and he loves his tennis and he's just a good bloke, as we say. And, you know, always wanted to get him on the show and he just... he's a class act and you know, knows what he's talking about. He's been around the world and one of the great entertainers of all time. And it's always fascinating to hear his views about, you know, tennis. And he's a really good guy, really good guy.
Please remember to press that subscribe button and share with all your friends. You can also follow us on Twitter, RNR_tennis. And of course on Instagram, Rock and Roll_tennis. And please leave us a review. We'd love to hear your comment. And in the meantime, do check out the best retro tennis clothing anywhere on the Golden Age of Tennis website, www.goldenageoftennis.com.